It's a pleasure for me to be able to introduce Professor Stephen A. Long, who's professor of theology at Ave Maria University. I've known him for years. We've been able to argue through almost every issue, not only in theology, but also history and everything else. He is a delightful conversation partner, rarely in agreement, last of the Bonnesians, but always fascinating and always interesting. He's author of famous Analogia Entis, on the analogy of being, metaphysics, and the act of faith, but also Natura Pura, that got many of us thinking, woke us up, and returned us to text that we might not have been reading with enough care. And then the theological grammar of the moral act that also shaped some of my students' own research and is being used in programs of moral theology and philosophy throughout the country and throughout the world. So again, always fascinating, always interesting. I, with no further ado, introduce Stephen A. Long, who will speak to us. Well, I'll let him introduce his talk.
Thank you, Father Michael. I must say it's daunting to be introduced as always interesting. But this will be interesting, perhaps, if only by way of exception. So, without more ado, I want to turn to the subject. My principal object today is to explain the centrality and transcendence of the common good, to correctly address the nature of the common good of political society. One must understand that before and as a condition of being, a political or social principle, common good is an intrinsic constitutive principle of the moral, metaphysical, and theological orders. And it is essentially a teleological principle, an end. My aim is to focus upon the work of St. Thomas Aquinas, which articulates a teaching found throughout the Catholic tradition and normative for it. First, I will refer to the common reading of the account of the common good given in Gaudium et Spes from Vatican II, and immediately thereafter attempt to clarify the strategic difference between this common interpretation and the stronger understanding to be found in the Catholic tradition. Second, I will offer an initial account of the transcendence of the common good as a central analogical principle within Catholic thought. Third, I will offer a few words about the common good of political society and the virtue of legal justice. Fourth, I will address the essentially teleological and theonomic character of the common good and its defining role both for natural and divine law as participations of the eternal law, especially in their normative relation to political and social order. Gaudium et Spes, number 26, articulates the nature of the common good in this way, quote, "Every day, human interdependence grows more tightly drawn and spreads by degrees over the whole world. As a result, the common good, that is the sum of those conditions of social life, which allows social groups and their individual members relatively thorough and ready access to their own fulfillment, today takes on an increasingly universal complexion and consequently involves rights and duties with respect to the whole human race. Every social group must take account of the needs and legitimate aspiration of other groups and even of the general welfare of the entire human family," end quote. This definition draws attention to the wider order of which one is a part, an order that is required in defining the rectitude of the part with respect to the whole. Yet, quote, "the sum of those conditions of social life which allow social groups and their individual members relatively thorough and ready access to their own fulfillment," end quote, may suggest that the common good is being viewed here as what we might identify as a common utility in economic language. a utility that finally reduces to the good of individuals qua individuals. Viewed in this way, the role of communio, of solidarity and good, and of noble higher good would be excluded from the account of common good. That is to say, were this reading to be construed as the most formal account, this interpretation of Gaudium et Spes, then common good would be understood in a purely instrumental manner. And the truth that certain common orderings of individuals in society are requisite to the good of individuals would exhaust the formal character of the common good. Gaudium et Spes, however, does not seem to be intended formally to address the question whether the good of the individual itself is merely an individual good. That is, it does not overtly address the foundational issue whether good is reducible to private and incommensurable goods of individuals. It merely identifies that a common ordering is requisite to the good of individuals, whatever good may mean, leaving aside the issue whether all goods of individuals are individual or private goods. Thus, Gaudium et Spes often is read as treating the common good materially and instrumentally. It may appear to treat it materially in two ways. First, whatever the good for the human person is, there are aspects of the ordering of society requisite to and instrumental for this good. The good is treated not formally and in its nature, but merely materially, as something to which other things must generally be ordained if it is to be achieved. Second, it is treated materially in that the sum of these conditions, clearly and unequivocally a quantitative formulation, is taken to comprise the common good. So the formulation of Gaudium et Spes, apart from further reference to the tradition, can appear simply to assert that there are conditions that must generally obtain for the sake of human good, and that the totality of these is what we mean by common good. Yet it is one thing to say that methodologically there is room for an analysis of common utilities, so that in one plausible meaning of common good, we can refer to these as common goods. It is another thing to answer the question whether all goods of human persons are private goods. I wish to note that it can be argued, I think correctly, that the proper translation of Gaudium et Spes number 26 should be not their own flourishing, but their proper perfection, as the Latin is proprium perfectionem. This opens the reading of the document to the wider tradition. Yet without more specific reference to the tradition, proprium perfectionem is not of itself adequately specified and may tend to be taken to refer to private goods. Since the right way to read such a document as Gaudium et Spes is always in accord with the universal tradition, we need to advert to that tradition. What I've called the common reading of Gaudium et Spes falls short of the normative treatment of the common good articulated in the Catholic tradition. Two points manifest this. The first is that the common good, precisely as good, is not merely a totality of conditions instrumentally helpful, but is distinguished from private good, not merely quantitatively, but formally. Aquinas has articulated the tradition on this point with great precision in question 58, article 7, add 2 of the Secunda Secundae of the Summa Theologiae. Quote, the common good of the realm and the particular good of the individual differ not only in respect of the many and the few, but also under a formal aspect. For the aspect of the common good differs from the aspect of the individual good, even as the aspect of whole differs from that of part. Wherefore the philosopher says that they are wrong who maintain that the state and the home and the like differ only as many and few and not specifically, end quote. Thomas amplifies this teaching later in the Secunda Pars, arguing, quote, now every part is directed to the whole as imperfect to perfect, wherefore every part is naturally for the sake of the whole, end quote. Note the emphasis upon the normative order of part to whole. The relation is not merely materially and extensively quantitative, but addresses the formal ratio of part to whole as a commensuration of part to whole, a formal ordering of part to whole. This doctrine is, of course, found throughout the tradition. One thinks of Augustine arguing in the Confessions that, quote, there is faultiness and deficiency in every part that does not fit in with the whole of which it is a part, end quote. Thomas insists strongly upon this principle as intrinsic to his account of the nature of the good. As he puts it, quote, the common good takes precedence of the private good if it be of the same genus, end quote. One may rightly, on this view, prefer the common good to the individual good, something manifest in his treatment of the death penalty and of just war, but which is a principle of far greater formal importance and generality. While the semantics of this teaching to American minds raises the specter of collectivism, of a subordination of the individual to the collective conceived as an alien good, this would be to materialize the nature of common good, which is something formal. In other words, it is the human person as such who is ordered both to private and to common goods. And common goods are not alien to the person, but rather the higher or nobler perfection of the person. Indeed, the dignity of the human person is chiefly a function of the ordering of human nature to noble or common good. The second point where the common interpretation of Gaudium et Spes falls short is that the common good is an end, is itself a good, and a good of a radically different kind than individual or private good. It is a good which is radically more communicable by its very nature. According to St. Thomas, the common good is, quote, common not by the community of genus or species, but the community of final cause. As he puts it, quote, actions are indeed concerned with particular matters, but those particular matters are able to be referred to the common good, not as to a common genus or species, but as a common final cause, according to which the common good is said to be the common end, end quote. The common good has a universality that is not merely that of predication or of the mode of our conceiving it. It exhibits a causal universality consisting in its intrinsically greater communicability, its goodness as an end. We may all share a pizza, but the food that one eats is not the food eaten by another, which is numerically distinct. This is a private or individual good. By contrast, consider the striving of many persons to discover truth, or to achieve victory in battle, or to see that justice prevails in some difficult matter. These goods are rejoiced in by all who labor for them. The good is the truth is the good sought by all honest inquirers. Victory is the good sought by all who fight for it. Justice is the good sought by all who work for it. It is the same numerical good to which all have ordered their efforts. And while it is the private good of none of the parties, it is indeed good for each. It is a good of and for the individual, but it is not an individual good. Such a good is by its nature communicable to many without diminution. It is more intelligibly irradiant, more universal, precisely as an end. By the very nature of truth or justice as ends of noble striving, these may be enjoyed by many with no diminution. The end or good of truth is not altered or diminished by being communicated to many. If we share pizza and one person has more, the other by force of necessity has less. But this manifestly is not the case with truth. Likewise, if a judge does justice in one case, he is not compensatorily obliged to do injustice in the next, despite what the Supreme Court's been doing lately. Justice as a common good is numerically one, but it is the singular possession of none. Although this is the manner in which the tyrant loves the city, as a singular good, as assimilating it to his own private good, rather than as a noble good to be honored, guarded, sacrificed for, and served. In this light, we discern that the common good, as truly good, is thus an object of noble striving. It does not properly capture the actual nature of what is at stake. In the first wave at Normandy Beach, where the soldiers bled the beaches red with their blood, to speak of this as sacrifice for common utility. One may intelligibly sacrifice one's private good for the common good, as Socrates so conspicuously did in refusing even to seem to undercut the law of Athens by fleeing an unjust verdict, choosing instead to abide by the sentence of death. One does not reasonably die for the sake of lowering phone bills in the metropolitan area, but one might reasonably do so in behalf of justice, truth, mercy, love, noble friendship, or communion with God. The common good is the nobler and more universal good of the individual, but it is not an individual or private good. As a parenthetic note, this same observation obtains in a derivative manner with respect to what Pope St. John Paul II described as the virtue of solidarity, something of which man qua man is capable only because human nature is ordained to common ends or goods, which are noble perfections. St. Thomas distinguishes between intrinsic and extrinsic common good. Intrinsic common good is the good of a unity of order, the good of right order in a multitude, whereas extrinsic common good is that for the sake of which the intrinsic common good exists, as the right order of an army is for the sake of the extrinsic good of victory, which is the good of the general. And the general intends the right ordering of the army for the sake of victory. As Thomas puts it, quote, a good existing in the universe, namely the order of the universe, is an end thereof. This, however, is not its ultimate end, but is ordered to the extrinsic good as to the end. Thus, the order in an army is ordered to the general, as stated in Metaphysics 12. The intrinsic common good is specified by and is for the sake of the extrinsic common good. The architectonic role of the common good is manifest in Thomas's understanding of law as such, whether we speak of the law of the state, the natural law, or the divine law. Law is an ordinance of reason issued and promulgated by the one with the care of the community for the sake of the common good. As Thomas puts it in Summa Theologiae Prima Secundae, question 90, article 2, ad 3, quote, just as nothing stands firm with regard to the speculative reason except that which is traced back to the first indemonstrable principles, so nothing stands firm with regard to the practical reason unless it be directed to the last end, which is the common good. And whatever stands to reason in this sense has the nature of a law, end quote. Every genuine common good is a participation in the ultimate extrinsic common good of the universe, namely God. For the common good, absolutely speaking, is God, whose good is participated in every created good and toward whom all things are ordered. At this point, it should be clear that common good as a good one in number, that of its nature is communicable to many, is an analogical perfection, which may be found in progressively greater radiance from the common good of political society through the indwelling common good of the right ordering of the universe with respect to God and onward to the ultimate extrinsic common good of the universe, who is God. the law of the state is indeed either reached by conclusion from natural law or by determination of the natural law in respect of some contingent matter which must be ordered in accord with natural law in one of the ways in which it is prudently orderable. Further, the very natural order of ends, which specifies human action and human virtue, is itself a common good, inasmuch as it formally constitutes the natural good, so that conformity with this order becomes itself a noble end of striving. We see the theonomic character of common good in the following lines of St. Thomas in Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 3, Chapter 17, quote, "Further, a particular good is ordered to the common good as to an end. Indeed, the being of a part depends on the being of the whole. So also the good of a nation is more godlike than the good of one man. Now the supreme good, namely God, is the common good, since the good of all things depends on him. And the good whereby each thing is good is the particular good of that thing and of those that depend thereon. Therefore, all things are directed to one good, namely to God as their end." End quote. This is decisive for law as such, since as Thomas teaches in Summa Theologiae Prima Secundae, question 93, article 3, all true law is a participation in the eternal law and must derive from and be in conformity with it. Since then the eternal law is the plan of government in the chief governor, all the plans of government in the inferior governors must be derived from the eternal law. But these plans of inferior governors are all other laws besides the eternal law. Therefore, all laws, insofar as they partake of right reason, are derived from the eternal law. Hence, Augustine says that in temporal law there is nothing just and lawful, but what man is drawn from the eternal law. End quote. It is here that we must understand Thomas's doctrine of natural law in order to grasp the profound unity of the common good and its spiritual, moral, political, and social normativity. Nonetheless, before turning to this more complete context for the understanding of the transcendence of the common good, it is reasonable first to speak of the limited but real transcendence of the political common good and its necessary relation to virtue. For Aquinas and for the Catholic tradition, the political common good is the good of an ordered multitude in relation to the happiness of the community, which is found in virtuous living. As Thomas writes regarding Aristotle's teaching in the Politics, quote, "For it is of the nature of the city that in it should be found everything sufficient for human life. He, Aristotle, shows to what it is ordered. For it is originally made for living, namely that men might find sufficiently that from which they might be able to live. But from its existence it comes about that men not only live, but that they live well insofar as by the laws of the city, human life is ordered to the virtues." End quote. It might be thought that this is simply what the common interpretation of Gaudium et Spes affirms, namely that the common good is the sum of the social conditions requisite to the good of persons. Yet what is considered is not merely instrumentality towards goods, which are private goods. Rather, what is at stake is the right ordering of a multitude for the sake of the community's happiness, which consists in virtuous life. Granted that the common good concerns also the survival and material flourishing of the community, all this is further ordered for the sake of the community's happiness and virtue. Virtuous life is, as it were, the extrinsic common good for the sake of which the common ordering is undertaken. And as every order is specified by its end, this ordering is specified by the nobler, more universal, more communicable common good, rather than by the merely private goods of citizens. Neither the private good of the individual nor the private good of the family are wholly sufficient for happiness and virtue. The dignity of the political community consists in the importance of its role in ordering citizens not merely to material prosperity, but to the life of virtue. As Thomas argues in Summa Theologiae, Prima Secundae, Question 92, Article 1, quote, "But every law aims at being obeyed by those who are subject to it. Consequently, it is evident that the proper effect of law is to lead its subjects to their proper virtue. And since virtue is that which makes its subject good, it follows that the proper effect of law is to make those to whom it is given good, either simply or in some particular respect. For if the intention of the lawgiver is fixed on true good, which is the common good regulated according to divine justice, it follows that the effect of the law is to make men good simply," end quote. He continues a little further, saying, quote, "If, however, the intention of the lawgiver is fixed on that which is not simply good, that, quote, then the law does not make men good simply. Thus a man is called a good robber," end quote. This is quite frankly merely to point out that law is teleological, that it is ordained to good, either real or merely apparent, and that real good must consist in a genuine ordering to the life of virtue, which alone can make the life of the community to be happy and peaceful. Yet there is no implication that the political common good exhausts or totally comprises the good for man. In fact, the political community itself is further ordered to the good, in relation to which it may be judged as good only secundum quid in a particular respect, but is bad in itself, as its citizen may be made good by it only secundum quid and not properly. For example, when a citizen becomes a good communist or a good Nazi, this falls short of being good, simpliciter. Yet the common good of political life consists in the direction to the good life and virtue, and as we have seen, it is formally and normatively defined by law in terms of this direction to the final end. Quote, "Nothing stands firm with regard to the practical reason unless it be directed to the last end, which is the common good, and whatever stands to reason in this sense has the nature of a law," end quote. Thus also legal justice in commanding the moral virtues is noblest of the moral virtues precisely because it causally directs all the other moral virtues to the common good, which transcends private good. Thomas states, quote, "If we speak of legal justice, it is evident that it stands foremost among all the moral virtues. For as much as the common good transcends the individual good of one person," end quote. Indeed, for this very reason, the political common good is subordinate to and is judged in relation to essentially nobler common goods. Limitation upon the power, the just power of the state, flows not merely from below, but from above, owing to the teleological ordering of lower common goods to nobler common goods. Just as private good is ordained to common good, so a less diffusive common good is ordained to a more diffusive or communicable common good. There is a tendency today to suppose that the only thing impeding a nanny state or a thoroughgoing collectivist disregard for the person is the health of private institutions. This is important, but even more important is the existence of authority that supersedes that of the political state and is associated with nobler common goods than that of the political state. For the good of the political community cannot be a good if it is sealed off from the ordering of the person, either in nature or in grace, to the ultimate common good. The very definition of law expresses this, and it is the foundation of the judgment mala lex nulla lex. An evil law is no law. A judgment that only makes the same kind of distinction about the bodies of law in a society that we make with respect to the biological good itself. as a tumor in some particular case is factively, but not normatively, a part of the body, so a putative law is in some case factively, but not normatively, a part of the body of laws. And as in the former case, no immediate particular therapy is dictated, so too in the latter. In each case, the effort to limit the bad effect of the disorder may take either the form of direct removal or some other form of mitigation. But the prudential limitations in correcting disorder do not imply that any command can, in and of itself, genuinely obligate anyone when it is contrary to the common good. Nor can such an edict be part of the normative body of law, just as the prudential limitations in treating bodily tumors do not constitute tumors as normative parts of the human body. The tumor and the unjust command are said to belong respectively to the body or to the law only by a weak analogy of attribution. Thus Thomas writes, quote, as Augustine says, that which is not just seems to be no law at all. Thus, according as the law is just, so far does it have the force of law. Now, in human affairs, the thing is said to be just inasmuch as it is right according to the rule of reason. But the first rule of reason is the law of nature, as is clear from what has been said above. Wherefore, every human law has just so much the nature of law, according as it is derived from the law of nature, lege naturae. But if something is at variance with the law of nature, it is no longer a law, but a perversion of law, end quote. The person is not subject to the political common good in all that he has and is, precisely because the person is ordained to nobler common goods than the political common good, goods that norm and that are constitutive for the authentic common good of political community. Yet while the degree to which the political community can conduce to virtue is limited both ontologically and prudentially, its contribution is nonetheless both real and essential. The common good of the community must be a good, a bonum honestum, and so it must be in accord with the nobler good of the society of persons and encourage this good to the degree possible, and certainly and minimally at least not undercut it. This is to say that there is a teleological hierarchy of common goods, of noble universal ends, which terminates in the beatific vision itself, the celestial city of the Beati, the saints. The virtuous life of the community cannot be furthered by, but can only be impaired or even destroyed by, the opposition of the political common good to the divine good, whether at the level of nature or at the level of grace. Deontology, rights, duties, and obligation, within such an account, pertains to that which is necessary for the sake of the end, for the sake of the common good. Thus, rights which articulate just claims, which others have a duty to acknowledge and to respect, are claims of justice that pertain in some way to what is positively or negatively required by the end. This means, however, that the truth about the end and about the order to the end is prior to any claim of right. Human rights are thus not the foundational discourse of political life, but derive from prior consideration of the nature of the good. Nor are rights absolute or unlimited, for they are limited from above in relation to the hierarchy of ends that norms the political common good, and from below in relation to the judgment of prudence indicating the constraints on such claims that may be placed by circumstance. Thus, rights as deontological functions are derivative of the truth about the order to the end. This is why rights claims and their proliferation today in Western society tend to engender radical disagreement. Lacking strong moral and legal consensus regarding the order of ends normative for the political common good, the proliferation of claims of right tends to lead merely to mutual antagonisms and oppositions. I have spoken repeatedly about the order of ends, which to a certain degree is to speak of the order of common goods as itself constitutive for the political common good of political society. I would like briefly to place these propositions in the context of the doctrine of natural law before saying a last word about the common good. In question 92, article 2 of the Prima Secunda of the Summa Theologiae, Thomas formally speaks of the natural law as a rational participation in the eternal law. Yet he also speaks of a participation in the eternal law common to all things, from which all things derive their inclinations to their proper acts and ends. This mode of participation commonly is understood to be a passive participation, whereby all creatures receive their being, nature, powers, and the ordering and activation of these powers towards objects and ends from God. Since this order terminates in the ultimate end proportionate to nature, because all things according to their natures are ordered toward the good of the cosmos and toward God as the first cause and last end of the cosmos, as, quote, the beginning and end of natural good, as Thomas says, in distinguishing it from God as supernatural beatitude, this order is a passively participated teleological order, an order of ends. In question 94, article 2, Thomas makes very clear in his respondeo that the order of precepts follows the order of inclinations. And what does the order of inclinations follow, if not the order of the ends that specify those inclinations? The order of precepts follows the order of inclinations, which follows the order of ends. Thus, in his famous analysis of question 94, article 2 of the Prima Secunda of the Summa Theologiae, we find Thomas teaching that first there is the inclination of all creatures toward perseverance in being according to their natures and the precepts deriving from this inclination. Second, inclinations that befall man because of the nature we share with other animals and the precepts derived from these. And thirdly, there are those inclinations specific to reason and the precepts that follow. Of course, precept as such is rational, but the order of precepts follows the order of inclinations, which follows the order of ends. What is norming the reason is the order, the teleological order, which is passively participated. Because this order normatively specifies the natural good, just so far it is itself a common good. Because this is a less diffusive good than the good of the supernatural order, in the regime of grace, it is itself further ordered to the supernatural good. For this reason, a private good of a higher order may be superordinate to a common good of a lower order, as the least subjective participation of grace as a supernatural principle is superior to the natural common good of the universe. The passive participation of the eternal law often is treated as merely physical, a brute necessary condition for natural law that, however, provides no normative content. But clearly the eternal law, as the type of the governance of things in the divine mind, as Thomas defines it, cannot be directly cognized through man's natural powers. It can be known only insofar as this ordering wisdom of God, which is the eternal law, is impressed upon nature. It's interesting, ontologism, it remains under anathema. In the decree of the CDF, which said one could read Rosmini more charitably than to think he was an ontologist, under Ratzinger, there was included the proposition that, however, if one were to read Rosmini as affirming ontologism, the anathema stands. Thus, the passively participated teleological order is the impress of the eternal law not merely on physical creation, but on creation as such. It is that from which all things receive their inclinations to their proper acts and ends. This purely passive participation does not yet occur in the mode of law, because law passes from a mind to a mind, from the mind of the legislator to the mind of the recipient. Whereas passive participation of the eternal law is the ontological foundation for natural law. Only when and insofar as this passively participated order is received rationally and preceptively as providing authoritative direction about what is to be done and what is not to be done, communicating reasons for action, is this order received as natural law. These reasons for action, ends, are not discrete and disconnected in that what is a good in itself and an end will in all but one case be also further ordered toward nobler ends. The reason for this consideration of the normativity of the order of ends and hence of the order of common goods is, I hope, manifest. Absolutely speaking, as St. Thomas teaches, the common good is God. All goods are analogical participations of the divine good via divine efficient, final, and exemplar causality and are teleologically ordered to God according to their natures. Thus, there is an order of goods wherein private good is ordained to common good, and there is an order of common goods rising through the political common good and surpassing it. Political common good transcends private good and is irreducible to it, but there is an order of ends which encompasses progressively more irradiant and profound common goods, all of which are ordered to the divine common good, naturally and supernaturally. It is this order which norms all human action whatsoever, and of which the political common good forms a part, which is commensurated to it as to its proper whole. This is why the political life is limited and normed not merely from below, but from above, by virtue of its teleological specification by nobler goods and in relation to nobler goods. This is also, by the way, why Dignitatis Humanae needed to insist and did insist that its teaching regarding religious liberty, quote, leaves untouched traditional Catholic doctrine on the moral duty of men and societies toward the true religion and toward the one Church of Christ, end quote. This is why you find John Paul II in his pontificate would always say political communities have an obligation to acknowledge the full truth about human destiny. Because if the political community is closed off from nobler common good, it itself ceases to be a common good. It is specified by its teleological ordering to nobler goods. And when it loses that, when it becomes an adversary to it, just so far does it cease to be a true common good. It's no longer a bona monest. In conclusion, the common good of political community is constituted in relation to nobler common goods of justice, truth, friendship, and virtue, communion with God, and proportionate to the life of the community, either promotes more motion toward these goods, or at least seeks to preserve them from harm. The intrinsic common good of the right ordering of the commonwealth toward the specifying extrinsic common good of virtuous life and the happiness of the community is itself a limited conformity to the divine good. Common good is an analogically central principle for Catholic theology and philosophy, as well as for the mystical life, precisely because, as Thomas affirms in the Summa Contra Gentiles, the supreme good, namely God, is the common good, since the good of all things depends on him. And as he states, therefore all things are directed to one good, namely to God, as their end. The common good truly is the higher, more universal, more communicable good of the individuals who participated, who in one sense are as parts with respect to that good. Less diffusive common good also is subordinate to more diffusive and nobler common good, is specified in relation to it, and thus in a distinct sense stands to it as part to whole. The political community is not the entirety of the order, morally, ontologically, spiritually, and it is normed by a teleological ordering to nobler common goods, of which it has some participation. Thus, man is teleologically ordered to God through the hierarchy of progressively more communicable common goods, terminating at the common good who is God himself communicated in beatific vision. Subordinate common goods are further specified by their teleological order to loftier common goods. In the speculative order, there's a great deal to say about this owing to the illumination of the metaphysics of participation by the Aristotelian distinction of act and potency. And in the practical order, there are profound implications for contemporary discussions of religious liberty. But I believe I've run out of time and possibly out of your patience. So thank you.
So I just wanted a clarification about the way the virtues are ordered within the common good, and particularly the individual moral virtues. So you were saying how things like truth and justice are communicable and are not exhausted, right? So if you know truth, that doesn't exhaust truth. You haven't used up all the truth. I can still know the truth as well. But if you are temperate, I don't share in your temperance at all. So would we say that those virtues, those, what we might say are kind of more private moral virtues, are part of that common good, that virtue which you were speaking of? Or are they ordered towards that as a means by which we can affect justice? If everyone in the room is temperate, then we're more likely to have a just society than if we're all intemperate?
Yeah.
I just, could you speak on the relation of those?
Sure. I mean, my instinct is to be lazy and to say that the simplest way to do this would be as the crow flies and say, look, the ordering of ends norms all the virtues. That ordering of ends is itself, in this respect, a common good. That is, it norms the good life, and it is participable by many with no diminution. And so the simple way to handle this is, in a way, just to be, you know, 50,000 feet above your question, and to say, well, this is part of one common good. And I do think that in a certain most formal way answers the question. Now, but you're right, that answer in a way includes the ordering of private goods to common goods. And your question is, in what way is temperance, could we think of temperance as a common good? But temperance has, if you like, this concerns conduct that is not simply private. And insofar as legal justice commands all the virtues, it commands them precisely as bearing upon the common good of political society, for example. And so clearly political intemperance is more than an individual defect. It is an individual defect, but it's more, its destructiveness and harm is more than that. Likewise, political temperance is more than an individual good. Does this help?
Yeah, although what would you make the distinction between political temperance and private temperance?
Well, I mean, whether I eat too many mushrooms, you know, is on the private side. But you can say, look, if I am habitually temperate in small matters, if I have the habitus of temperance, and this is affected by how many mushrooms I eat, whatever it is, more properly, how much single malt Lafroy I ingest. picking something dear to my heart. Insofar as it's connected to the habitus of temperance, which extends itself to broader and broader orderings to the good, just so far this extends beyond the realm of individual private good.
Okay, we have a question back here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Long. My question is, if if the political common good is this right order which is constituted by virtuous living, why is it that this virtuous living would be merely a matter of natural virtue and not supernatural virtue? Why would we make a distinction there?
Well, in a way, you've asked two different questions, because I think the answer to the first part of your question is different than the answer why we'd make a distinction. I mean, I think we'd make a distinction because they're distinct orderings. But the first part of the question, I think, is important. And I don't think that the further ordering of nature in grace is a simply private phenomenon, nor has the church ever ceded this point. So I didn't mean to suggest that that societies as such do not have duties with respect to the one Church of Christ. And in fact, I think I disagree with Courtney Murray on some points and agree on others, but I certainly agree with him when in his notes, I think it's in the Abbott edition of the Vatican documents of Vatican II, he says that the council had no intention whatsoever of addressing the confessional state or of suppressing it. And the fact of the matter is, just as today in secular estates, they're very happy to say, look, you can hold anything you want. You can have your little private obsession about God as long as it doesn't creep into the public realm. There's absolutely nothing that would prevent, in a densely Catholic society, a Catholic state from having the same attitude toward, say, atheism and agnosticism, saying, you're perfectly free to be an agnostic and atheist if you think that things just pop out of nothing, you know, okay, I mean, that's all right, we're going to be kind to you, but the state is juridically still subject to a higher order. So I didn't mean to suggest in any way that by emphasizing the natural in the way that I have done, I do this because I think this is what Thomas does. For example, he'll treat grace analogically in terms of form, which is a principle that's been developed in the natural analysis first, right? So I wanted to show the foundation of this in the proportionate natural and philosophic analysis, which serves then as a sort of analogical template in the theological contemplation. I hope that's a little helpful.
My question is on the intrinsic common good of a political society. You identified the extrinsic common good as a life of virtue. I'm just wondering a little bit about the intrinsic common good or the order itself. What does that consist in? Does it consist in the regime itself, the kind of political regime you have, the people, the ruler? Would you be able to speak to that a little bit?
Well, it is itself an order, right? So in other words, it is. You could put it this way. Think about the way it has something in common with analogy of attribution, in the sense that we refer to the justice system, for example, right? Now, we understand that there's never been a justice system politically that hasn't had defects and corruptions. But we name it by the extrinsic common good to which it's ordered, right? So that whole ordering, that whole apparatus whereby we try to preserve justice, we try to immunize the innocent from unjust sanction. We try to guarantee that there is sanction where there is grave guilt. That's part of the political common good. Right, the share of a given society in the nobler common goods, which make for the life of virtue, reflected in the ordering within that society, which is distinctive, which is an achievement of men and women over time, a great sacrifice, for which we have affection, toward which we have piety. That's, I don't know if I'm helping, if I'm answering you. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Noll. At the beginning of your talk, you made a big point of the fact that the common good differs not just quantitatively, but formally from the individual good. And I was wondering what that is owing to. So my question is that simply, does that happen, does a common good, which differs not just quantitatively but formally from individual goods, arise every time individual agents aim at a common final end? Or does that arise only when those agents are individually insufficient or imperfect to achieve that end individually? So for example, to put a more concrete point on it, if men were sufficient to achieve all their ends qua individuals, would there therefore cease to be a common good to us which differs not just quantitatively but formally from our individual goods?
Well, you can see this in God, right? God requires no help. Certainly none from me, absolutely speaking, in order to possess the fullness of the common good of beatitude, which is his. So it is true that this distinction of part to whole as imperfect to perfect has to do with the ordering to common goods, which are perfections, which are progressively greater actuations. And in this way, there is this aspect of completion, of achievement. I don't know if you've seen, have any of you seen this film, The Martian? Anybody see that? Do you know what I'm talking about? Who's only one person? Not, oh, okay, a few more. Okay, do you remember that there's a splendid invocation in there of this fellow who is, he's lost on Mars. They left him behind. They thought he was dead. And they figure out he's alive, and they restore radio communication, but things aren't going well. And it looks like he's not going to make it. And there's this little passage I ran into the other day. I want to read it. He talks, he finally gets this sign of communication, and he's speaking with someone who's on a mission that is returning to Earth, the mission that left him behind. He says, "Commander Lewis, I may need you to do something for me. If I die, I need you to check in on my parents. They'll want to hear all about our time here on Mars. I know that sucks. It'll be hard talking to a couple about their dead son. It's a lot to ask, which is why I'm asking you. I'm not giving up. We just need to prepare for every outcome. Please tell them I love what I do. And I'm really good at it. And that I'm dying for something big and beautiful and greater than me. Tell them I said I can live with that. And tell them, thank you for being my mom and dad." Right? It's a little moving vignette in this thing. You know, I don't know why it is that science fiction has... Some of these guys are reading Aristotle or something, you know. There is this aspect of the completion of the person in noble good. It would be, sure, it would still be common good. It wouldn't be distinct from us if we didn't need activation to get there, right? In other words, God is the infinite good. And it's not that God isn't the common good if there's no creation. And so if we were if we needed no activation, if we needed no help moving us to superior perfections, I mean, these would still be superior perfections, I think, is the answer to your question.
We're going to take this as the last question.
Professor Long, thank you. Especially at the beginning of your talk, you helped us to understand how maddeningly slippery the term common good is, that both a pizza and justice, you know, are both common goods. But how do we apply that term common to both goods analogously? You know, how does that work? It's difficult to work through. My question is, why, how do I want to say it? I mean, obviously, something like a pizza, we predicate commonness to it because of the number of people who can share, you know, a pizza. But we have to divide that good in order for many to share it. So that's the common good in predicando, you know.
That's right.
And the family, the polis, are common goods, more properly speaking, in causando. Those are, you know, real final ends, you know, that people work to war and are incorporated into as constitutive parts. So between those two examples, I'd like to hear more about how you understand truth, justice as a common good. To me, that lies somewhere between those two. I may be wrong on that. But,
well, I think, I mean, I would want to say that the case of the pizza, sure thing. I'd want to say the case of the pizza is properly an individual or private good. It's only as you say, in a kind of conceptual way. We can say we shared wine together. But, what we mean is we each had our own wine. But we also shared a conversation and the contemplation of truth. And that's genuinely a common good. That is, it's an end. The very same truth is contemplable by each. You're right. There is this question of, you make me think if I need to be refuting Averroes. Right, that you have obviously different conceptualizations and so on the ontologically speaking, different cognitive acts. But what is achieved is the recognition, what is achieved is the same conformity of mind with thing. And you can say, well, it's the same only in a certain respect. But in the objectum, it's the same, is what we mean to say, right? The end that is sought is that. In other words, I don't seek in knowing the good. I don't seek chiefly just some kind of particular configuration of my mind as a separated good from the truth achieved. I seek it, and I seek it precisely as communicable, as a communicable good. Likewise, justice. You know, if you get a speeding ticket, you show up to court and they say, look, long about 10 a.m., we ran out of justice, son. You know, you want to be crucified or beheaded, you know? I mean, it's sort of, it's just, you don't, this is not a private good. This is not, you know, the same, I've been involved, I'm sure many of you have been, in difficult cases where you know people who are suffering unjustly. And if you haven't been involved in such a case, you probably will at some point. And many people may engage. Many people may engage with a certain hazard. They're seeking the same numeric good, that in this, that justice be vindicated, right? Many ordered to one, the same numeric good is the common good that defines their effort. It's not their private good. So I would want to say these are very, in a very strong way, common goods.
Please help me thank Professor Long.